council should make rules and where the minister should make this regulation, right? No. you're talking about the bullet bill?
Yes.
The vacancies. Possibly tomorrow. Is that okay? Is that okay? All parties? Everyone's happy with that. Good. All right, we have the fourth draft, and which reflects the discussions of 3 and 4 September, which was last week. So, is there anything in this fourth draft, Mrs. Dyer, Skosana, and co., that we should look at?
Thanks, Chair. Let's first start by conveying the apology of Mr. Lawrence Bassett. He has a tight commitment to only be coming later this afternoon or tomorrow morning. So we'll continue with deliberations and we will be, I think perhaps the first will be to ask Velma to take us through certain features from the previous draft, and you can see how we indicate changes we have made in terms of our draft. I think the best idea could be to finish off where we were last time and then come up, indicate the new revised versions we have put in at the instruction of the committee so that we work systematically. I don't know, but we'll be by the hands of the committee.
So I think that's the route we should follow, honourable members.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Thank you, Chair. The changes made pursuant to the last meeting is are indicated in curly brackets and italics. Those are the deletions. And the proposed insertions are in capital letters and underlined. On the first page of the bill, there was an alternative option for the long title inserted, as requested by Honourable Member Smuts. And I don't know if you would like me to read through it.
No. Is that necessary? No, is it necessary for her to read through it?
There's one question that was raised.
All right, let's raise
the
question.
That's all that depends on where you're going to go with it. It's the question in the very last footnote, but I'm not going to address it.
All right, fair enough.
For me, of course, much depends upon what you do.
Okay.
Thank you. Chair, on page 3.
Yes. Dr. Mitchell. No. Yes, of course it would. No, Mr. Dr. Mitchell. How we proceed in this committee is that when we agree that an option should be placed in the bill for consideration, it's merely that, an option. And in this case, it's an alternative option. So there's no decision that's been taken. All right?
Thank you, Chair. On page 3, there is a drafting change that was made. Text in italics in the curly brackets are being deleted as it is properly addressed in other lines.
This is perhaps an emphasis moment. May I just raise something which I have mentioned before?
Mm-hmm.
It pertains to the footnotes 10 and 15. What I have proposed is not what is reflected here. The minute we get deeper into the bill, it is correctly reflected. The idea of the reflection, broad reflection of the demographics, which we have based upon the Constitution. The word broad in each instance at footnote 10 and 15 appears in the wrong place. It should read, the legal provision is not broadly representative of the demographics of South Africa. And in the next place it should read, provide a legislative framework for the rationalization, restructuring, blah, 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 which is broadly representative of the Republic's demographics under a single regulatory body. That's the way the Constitution does it. That's the way you do it throughout the bill, correctly. But it, perhaps because, I don't know why, perhaps because I first raised it under the first clauses, it keeps coming up wrong in these clauses. So could we please just agree to do here what we've done through the rest of the bill, insert the word broadly before the word representative. Then we are compliant to the Constitution.
Chair, I'm just paging through the bill. The next change from last week was on page 14. It is in clause 6,000 functions of the council. We redrafted the clause to separate the maize and the must.
Tells me that you have page 13 as it is, and then over the page it's 15, but then you see this. Page 13 ends with subclause O. There's no P and Q. There's no P. All right. Not yet. You have considered and grant the series and loan. All right, P is pretty straightforward, so that's fine. Been deleted? Ah, okay.
May I just, before we leave the place, the exact same point I've just made about broadly representative, the same problem occurs on page 10 at 3B Roman 3, where it should read in the second line, in order to have a legal profession that broadly reflects the demographics of the Republic.
Okay.
And on the next page, 11, at 5I, promote access to a legal profession and pursuit of a legal profession that broadly reflects the demographics.
All right, we've got that.
Chief, can I move on to page 15?
Mm-hmm.
There was an insertion. This is to, we are still at the further alternative option for subclause 1 of clause 6, and this is in the must. The previous was the may. I don't know if it's necessary for me to go through everything.
Okay. That's on our page 17, Honourable Members. On the fourth draft. We've got copying problems here, so bear with us, please. Fair enough. So essentially there you have, in subclause one, two options to consider and decide upon, eh? Yes, but it still have two options there, isn't it?
That will be the further alternative option will be the one we go for. It purely just takes out all the mays and mentions it once, and it takes out all the musts and mentions the word must once.
Oh, I see what you've done there. But all right, we'll just go through it with a fine tooth comb.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Now I understand. Are you all on board, honourable members? Good.
Chair, clause 7.1, the composition of the council. Ms. Smith requested that an option be inserted to change the number of the legal practitioners to 18 and make it equal numbers, namely 9 attorneys and 9 advocates.
This chair was after Dr. Moseja and I reached agreement that you should have not regional councils, but provincial councils. We are bringing the whole profession in compliance with the new constitutional order, and there should therefore be, just as we no longer cater for Bantustans and are repealing those acts, you should respect the 9 provinces. And it was whilst we were grappling with the difficulty of subsection 2, which requires the council to be representative of race, gender, disability, regions, provision of legal services, and 7 Roman numerals of other considerations, that we said, why don't we just say 1 advocate from each province, 1 attorney from each province? Then you've solved your regional or provincial representativity problem. That is the background for the thinking here.
Sorry, I apologize. Chairperson, unless I misunderstood the discussion, I saw it as an alternative, but I did not see it as a agreed substitution. I was going to ask the same thing.
As far as I'm concerned, it is what we should do.
Yes, but
whether,
it's an alternative.
No, I heard you. The majority party MPs will no doubt indicate whether this is their final position or not. It's just incidentally a council of 24, 9 plus 9 plus 1 academic plus 3 ministerials plus 1 legal aid plus 1 board, fidelity board, for a total of 24. But if memory serves, we've given the chair a casting vote.
Okay.
Chairperson,
there's no firm decision on this matter.
But from a drafting point of view,
yes.
If it's left the way it is, I'm suggesting that there's no leeway to choose. There's an existing draft that was discussed by the committee.
Yes.
And then there are alternatives. This is the one alternative.
Yes.
And in my mind, in the way in which the committee has worked through the bill, each time it dealt with a particular aspect that it wanted to further amend, we as the drafters did it in the manner of providing alternatives, further alternatives, and the like in the various drafts. I see this as a deviation from that process.
What I'm suggesting is
that we retain the original the original draft, and that this be reflected as the alternative.
Chairman, I respect the position of Mr. Dyer, who, after all, answers to principles. But what is captured here is, I think, actually correct as a reflection of the committee's discussions, and we, after all, give instructions for the drafting. In my recollection, there was agreement that this is what should be said.
Ms. Dr. Mishra, I thought that we agree that we have been developing alternatives, and this is one of the alternatives that we develop. Now, I can't see why we have to fight over that thing, because we have an alternative. We accept it as an alternative, and then let's proceed.
All right. The point Mr. Dyer is making is that normally it must be reflected as such, as an alternative, would the original draft present there. And that's not what we have here.
I'm just defending the persons who did this
draft,
because in my view, they caught what they captured, what was instructed.
All right. But anyone reading this would imagine that what is in 7 is... Yes. It doesn't reflect as an alternative. All right.
Chair, should I change the drafting, make it a whole alternative subclause 1?
We can refer to the original bill for the original draft. Leave it as it is.
Okay, thank you. Then, clause 7.1b. Initially, the bill as drafted provided for 1 teacher of law. Then it was changed to 2 teachers of law. And then I just here refer to the composition of the transitional council. It was decided last week that the transitional council should only provide for 1 teacher of law. I just want the committee to consider well whether we should change it here also again to 1 teacher, or should the final council have 2 teachers of law.
To pass it through for consistency. We had quite a lengthy discussion about the transitional council, and that at the end of the day we decided that it would be in the best interest only to have 1, because there's 1 representative body that appoints them. So I would suggest that for consistency's sake we make the same for the council purposes and put that in as an option. But I think that there was the whole, we discussed the whole issue of, I think Mr. Dyer helped us again, that there's only 1 body that actually represents the deans, and they nominate a person. And I think that was what we discussed, and that's why we got to the transitional council 1 member. So I would suggest we make it 1 member here as well. I don't know if you wanted it merely as an alternative or as a final decision, Chair.
One of the reasons why we decided to do that was, first of all, because of the role that the council would play in legal education, continuing education, and so on. So that was one of the things. But we did also have this other idea that the Law Teachers Association would nominate 1. So if we're unsure about that, then it probably makes sense just to have the deans doing 1 out.
Here on the next page, there is an alternative option for subclause 2. We are still in 7 composition. I'm reading from the footnote. On 4 September, the question was raised whether subclause 2 will be practicable in its application. Reference was made to clause 64.5, which was argued to be more workable. The wording in clause 64.5 is more overused in other similar clauses. So what we did is we rearranged the wording of the alternative option for subclause 2, and then we made a further alternative, but the essence is the same. It's just a redrafting of the wording to make it consistent through the bill.
comments, questions? None? All right.
Clause 8, membership of council. Last week there was a decision to accept the further alternative option to paragraph C. Therefore, the alternative option and the original C were deleted. This was actually consequent to a discussion of clause 65, and I was requested to align clause 8 with this. But it's nothing new.
Are you happy with this, Mr. Swart?
I'm just
wondering,
are we on page 20?
Chair, my page numbers differ. It's 81. Oh, sorry, 82C. I'm sorry, 2C. Clause 9, the original one, as it was introduced, as well as the alternative to subclause 1, were deleted consequent to last week's discussion. And on 3 September, the committee decided that the further alternative to subclause 1, as discussed on 31 July, must be accepted.
Okay, this is an alternative that we agreed to put in there.
Clause 23 is the next one. On 3 September, Ms. Smith indicated that in her view, the investigation of compliance and discipline must be specifically delegated to the regional councils. This would be moving toward giving regional councils original power, which the bill does not intend to do. These changes are made for the committee's guidance. It is accepted that disciplinary issues and admissions would in any event be devolved to regional councils in practice. So,
what page, Mr. Scott? Yes. Yeah, right. Mine too. Okay, 28. Finishes on sub D. Over the page, it's 30. It's on 4. So it goes to the same piece. And we're on clause 23, which is one of the clauses missing there. All right, let's deal with the principle. And the principle is, should the councils, should we put into law the fact that the regional councils can only be the bodies dealing with disciplinary matters? If you want to think about it, that's what it says. That's what it says. It says that the legal practice council will not deal with disciplinary matters. effectively.
Yeah. Chair, I argued that it's completely unrealistic to think the council itself will do the investigation, the sifting, if you like, because I've said this now, I think, half a dozen times. The Law Society of the Northern Provinces alone takes in a given year 8,000 complaints. If you multiply that for ease and convenience by the four old provinces, that's 30,000 plus complaints. Are we seriously contemplating that the council at the national level will do the investigation before it sends the actual inquiries of only some hundreds, which is the normal thing, down to the regions or provinces? That is why I felt that disciplinary should go direct to the provinces. The more important point about devolution and residual original powers is, in my view, to be found and dealt with, especially in the committee's clause, which I think was 18. You know, for the Democratic Alliance, what will be crucial about this bill is the matter of the chambers, as we first argued, which we said for semantics don't matter, you can call them committees. But the point is that the committees must be the ones, both at the national level and then at the regional, they must be the ones who self-regulate. The essence of self-regulation of the professions, plural, is that you write your codes of conduct. Therefore, wherever, as a side remark, wherever in this bill there's reference to a code of conduct that is rejected by the Democratic Alliance, each profession must write its own code of conduct at the national level and at the regional. And inasmuch as your committee's clause, which I think is 18, inasmuch as it styles the committees as organs of the National Council, which remains seized and does not divest itself of the power that is rejected by us. There's also in clause 18, which I now for the life of me can't find, there's also a subsection which provides for a veto, which is totally unacceptable. So so that is the more fundamental devolution problem from the Democratic Alliance's point of view. You can't have a national council, especially if it remains with a vast majority of attorneys over advocates, which is just not fair. You cannot have such a national council devolving all powers but remaining but not divesting itself of them. You can't overrule what you give to the chambers or the committees. But the disciplinary aspect is a more practical thing. The reason is simply practical. I don't myself see how they can deal with 30,000 plus complaints. And that's using only the numbers from the existing statutory bodies. There will be more. How they can deal with all of them, I think it's just practical that you're going to ask your regions to do that sifting in the first place. And I would say that the attorneys must sift their own, the advocates must sift their own. If thereafter a premier party infractions of the code are found, I think there is a case for having a disciplinary committee, the final say, consisting of one each advocate, attorney, and layperson.
Dr. Mucheja and then Mr. Swart, followed by Mrs. Schaefer.
Chairperson, I think that this act, in a sense, is a transitional act. And that, therefore, its implementation will require management from the center, and also that its full implementation will have to be progressive. Now, if we are going to say from the outset we are giving the regional or provincial structures original powers, and we find that if there are challenges in setting up some of those regional provincial structures, we may end up with cases which cannot be taken for discipline because of those challenges. I wanted to suggest that for a start,
What helps with the must is if one says the council must delegate disciplinary matters to the regional council, we then deal with the capacity issues that we've argued at length are not in existence for the national council. We know they're only going to meet four times a year, and therefore we already then have got the structures in place. You've got your provincial bar councils, you've got your provincial law societies in place that can kick in immediately. Now the saving phrase is in section 6, which is your overarching power of the council. Section 6.1J, where the council must do all that is necessary, and here it says, delegate any of its powers and functions to its committees or regional councils subject to any conditions it may impose, which delegation does not divest the council of the power or functions so delegated, and preclude the council from varying or setting aside any decision made under the delegation. That's your power.
It's there.
Okay, that's my problem.
So now that's the first step. Then we need to discuss, I think that helps, but then to take it one step further, if you want original powers, then you're going to have to change 6.1J. Mm. But I think that there is a workable solution in that.
The workable solution
Mrs. Schaefer.
No, I just think the whole purpose of this bill is to change the way things are being done at the moment. And half the problem with things that are being done at the moment is that advocates and attorneys protect each other when it comes to disciplinary issues. So practically I think it is realistic that it's not going to be done at the council level. It must be done at the level of the provinces or regions or whatever. But there's got to be some kind of oversight power somehow to make sure that it's transparent and done. And I thought we'd agreed that a member of the public was going to be involved.
Clearly, this is one of those matters that requires a decision, so we're not going to be in a position to decide now.
Chair, but just can I give you what the solution would be? The solution would be
that... You have done that.
No. As to the matter of codes of conduct, the solution would be that the committees, the chambers or committees of advocates and attorneys respectively at the national level are the ones then with the original power which they devolve to. The regional chambers. That would be your answer if the son of the evolution model. Now, otherwise, your whole committees or chambers thing becomes anyway a chimera. Right? That is still an option as far as you're concerned, but for us, it is the party position.
Thank you, Chair. There are several things flagged in 23. The other thing is. There was a discussion whether there should be a regional council in every province, and if this is decided, perhaps the heading of this clause should change to establishment of provincial councils. And
no, I suggest we read the entire session on 3.1 because some of the members only have the page.
Yeah, unfortunately, please bear with us.
Yeah.
We don't have that page.
Yeah.
We've got the bottom, the last part of clause 23, but what you're referring to, we don't.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The heading would then be establishment of provincial or regional councils. 23.1, the council must, subject to subsection 2, establish 9 regional councils and may delegate to the regional council such powers and functions which, in the interest of the legal profession, are better performed at regional level. So clause 2A, the council must, at the commencement of chapter 2, establish at least 3 or 4 regional councils and the following factors must be taken into account. There may be no more than 1 regional council per province, the location of the seats of the divisions of the High Court, the efficient attainment of the council's objects, availability of resources, cost effectiveness and feasibility, the interests of legal practitioners and candidate legal practitioners, regional needs, interests and sensitivities, and the interest of the public. Subclause 2b, the minister must describe the areas of jurisdiction of regional councils after or in consultation with the council if the areas of jurisdiction of regional councils require revision any time after the commencement of Chapter 2. Subclause 3, the regional councils must carry out any powers and functions as may be determined by the council or set out in this Act. 4, regional councils must be elected in accordance with the procedure determined by the council in the rules. 5, regional councils must be constituted in such manner as to reflect the proportion of attorneys and advocates in the council. And then there were several things taken out. And then subclause 6, a regional council may establish one or more committees to assist it in the exercise of its power and performance of its functions. 7, a committee contemplated in subsection 3, a 6 may consist of only attorneys or only advocates to deal with matters relating exclusively to the attorneys' or advocates' professions, respectively. Chair, if I could just add there that these options at the beginning of this clause all relate to whether there will be a regional council in every province or not, and if so, at what stage. We had a bit of a challenge here because we say the council must establish at least 3 or 4 regional councils. Now we say there might be have to be one in every province, but this probably wouldn't be feasible immediately. So this is why we inserted the wording at the commencement of Chapter 2, establish at least 3 or 4. And then in subclause 1, we might insert the wording 9, keeping in account availability of resources or something like that, just to provide for an incremental approach if this were to be inserted in the bill.
Constitution establishes government in three spheres. Now, if we say regional, everybody will understand regional as per local government demarcation. And now this again imposes a duty on the minister to get involved in demarcation issues, identify where regions must be, which is another big job. And also, I think if I read this thing correctly, we're contradicting ourselves when we say we may not establish more than one region per province. Now, if it's not more than one region per province, then it means it's one provincial country.
I think from a drafting perspective, this may be improved in the same manner we dealt with the Supreme Court. Because if the committee decides that there are provincial councils in 9 terms of each region, you may then provide in the transition arrangement what you do if you don't have 9 immediately, which means we don't collapse everything at the same point, because issues of resources, issues of the demarcation of your councils are informed by the reality that until you have 9, others will have to be served by others as a start. And that allows incremental approach, because as and when you expand, you then have to again redemarcate and give others whatever session. And we have taken the very same approach in terms of the court, in the sense that as and when court established, currently the Act creates the Mpumalanga High Court. But in international arrangement for the problem space until such court has been established. Gauteng remains responsible for Mpumalanga, and the minister may by notice reclaim.
Infrastructure is there under the old four South African provinces that
we phase in from here into the new constitutional order?
I think as we work towards finalizing this matter, we need to be careful that we are not directed by people who doesn't want to let power go, who still want to cluster provinces and run everybody from the main city. And when you discipline lawyers, sometimes you find that these urban-based lawyers don't understand the challenges faced by attorneys who operate in the rural area. So I think we should really seriously consider not allowing this clustering of provinces, so that it's also a developmental matter that attorneys in the rural areas, taking into account the reality, they must be run their own affairs subject to the authority of the center, but they must have some autonomy.
Clearly, this is one matter that requires careful thought, Mr. Sibanyoni and Mr. Swart. And I hear the views expressed by Dr. Mocheha. I can't fault him, as well as Ms. Swart. But at the same time, you have to listen carefully to what Mr. Skosana says. So we have to take... I've always wondered why there's this law society that's involved in public. I've always... sounds like an anachronism. Yes. All right. This is what?
The thing that we seem to be broadly ad idem about is what Mr. Skosana says, it will then be a transitional. This is transitional. There's a lot of transitional. So we are thinking beyond what was discussed by the department and the profession, but it will be transitional. So it won't kick in immediately. You will, and maybe that's what we need to look at, is that option of putting something into the transitional arrangements that will allow for this to kick in over a period of time.
Yes, but the key question is, and this is the one Mr. Skosana is placing on the table for us to think about and decide, is do we want one council per province?
I think that's what we should aim at. We should aim at that.
All right.
And
then
like,
you need to then tell us how do we achieve
then
that.
The transitional phase, like the Superior Courts Bill that says Gauteng, for example, there are two seats, Gauteng and Mpumalanga now, high courts, but at the moment the Mpumalanga is not kicking in, so Gauteng still looks after Mpumalanga until that seat, or until that provincial council is set up. Then your existing councils can look up to it, and you fall back on your three or four existing councils that will look after those other provinces and probably do so now, because there must be blanket-to-blanket coverage at the moment throughout the country by those four constituent parts of the Law Society of South Africa.
Okay. And bear in mind, we're not only talking about Law Society, there's also the...
The Bar Council. Council.
All right. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to help Honorable Swart that it is Mpumalanga, not Mpumalanga. Mpumalanga.
Okay. Mr. Skosana, some more?
There's a point that will anchor what you discuss on in terms of the costing. One, the fact that it's in the body act that there will be one council per province. Already indict the profession to start thinking around that as they move along when they regulate their own affairs. And when we put the clause in the transfer arrangement that they must work on a costing analysis, they will the council will have that at the back of mind, the transfer council. That long term they must start preparing around this new evolution in terms of how it's going to be structured, whatever, etc. And the transfer arrangement can then deal with those immediate challenges
if you cannot, if you don't have enough lawyers in the Cape that constitute a body, if you don't have enough resources to get your own, whatever, you can have those other ones taking care of them. But gradually, the profession will know that that is the thing, the act says, primary ones want the profit, so they must look towards that long term.
Yeah, that's very important because we all know that people are that way, naturally. Once they have power, they don't want to give it up. And so you may have people in these bodies now so that when the time comes and they have to now translate into a provincial council and say, no, we want to hang on to what we've got. So the bill will have to be very carefully worded to make sure that that doesn't happen. Okay.
Yes, I'll be very brief.
Okay.
As Colonel was explaining, I was even thinking that in terms of the court, you may find that it's something that will easily flow. Why? Because I think everybody feels that there should be courts in all provinces. People of Bush Park Ridge or near Strait can't be expected to come to Pretoria for the High Court. Now, taking that example, put it in the legal profession, it may not be the same.
Yeah,
it may not be the same. I'm not being biased by it, but the evidence thereof is this difficulty in resolving these matters for all this number of years in transforming the legal profession. Transforming the judiciary may be the easy way than transforming the legal profession.
I agree with you.
I just think we should also be wary of the cost issue because, I mean, I've seen the cost things that have been tabled last week. I mean, and that's only really relating to the transitional arrangements, not the long-term running of the council. And if we're going to impose an obligation on the council to have one in every province and it's just not feasible, then that's also a problem. So I think if we're going to look at wording, we should allow that to be legitimately taken into account without encouraging gatekeeping, but I do think it's a legitimate issue.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clear for a drafting point of view, should we prepare an option of some sort here, or?
I think what everyone is saying, as I understand, there should be 9 provincial councils, honourable members, please correct me if I'm wrong, and then within the transitional arrangements, recognise the existing bodies, because as Mr. Susanna pointed out, when this is signed into law, the 9 provincial councils don't just automatically come into being. In the case of 1 or 2, that may happen, but as Mr. Susanna says, in the case of 2 or 3, it may not happen. And in that situation, people in the legal profession then will lean on what is already there. I hope we are helping.
Chairperson, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just thinking with my rural mind. If we don't have to put time frame on the provisional arrangement, because I suspect that the Gauteng and Cape Town lawyers would like to keep the powers that they have and not allow the rural provinces to have their own, which will keep many historically disadvantaged people away from the legal profession.
Okay, so not that. All right,
sir. Thank you, Chair. The next clause is clause 29 that deals with community service. My document, page 34.
Right.
There are several options here. There were more discussions last week on this. Regarding the further alternative options. This was the one that was basically used last week during the discussion. Clause 29.1 then would read, the council must make rules, or the minister must make, in or after consultation with the council, make regulations relating to community service by all candidate legal practitioners as a compulsory component of practical vocational training. The committee last week decided to delete that paragraph B that provides for all practicing legal practitioners upon which they continued enrollment as a legal practitioner is dependent. So it decided to delete this paragraph.
Okay.
Then further down in subclause 3, there was a discussion on the insertion of the Human Rights Commission. This comes later. This was just a drafting change. Chapter 9 institutions were referred to further on in subclause 3, but it was decided to move it to paragraph 3B. Service in an institution supporting constitutional democracy referred to in Chapter 9. So this is actually just a drafting aspect. And then also subclause 3, paragraph D, it was decided to delete this provision for service as a judicial officer. This is consequent to the deletion of the requirement for practicing legal practitioners to do community service, as well as paragraph E that provides for legal education. It was also decided that candidate attorneys can't do that.
The service which the candidate legal practitioner or the legal practitioner.
Yeah.
So that must also come out.
Okay.
And then we've got the cross-reference. So our discussion centered around the need mainly for community service to be as part of the LLB curriculum. Remember, Doctor, that was what we discussed. So is that in the other section? I think we've covered that already. And that was the main emphasis.
So that it's understood from the time that you enter university that community service forms part of your curriculum.
Chair, yes, I will just look at the clause. I think, if I remember correctly, that there is going to be a recommendation to the universities to provide for that in the curriculum. I don't think, I'm not sure whether this bill can impose it on them.
Okay.
I
also
have
Let's
to look
at
the
that. Dr.
Mushaha? We have a problem that we have universities that are churning out graduates that are as good as people who never studied anywhere. And they are not employable. And now, you know, if you train a doctor, you train them so that they can go and operate a person and do all that is necessary to keep people alive. Now, if you train a lawyer, that cannot apply the law. It's a waste of time. So I'm wondering why we can make it compulsory that the universities, as part of the legal training, build in community service. Because as well, you know, we produce lawyers that are elitists. You need to develop a social consciousness in a legal practitioner. And that community service will serve that purpose of having people develop a social conscience, because law is, you know, it's really about serving the people, not just a means to make money. Now, we produce lawyers who think that's practicing law just to make money because they don't have a social conscience.
Fair Clause 6.5 provides that the council, with regard to education in law and legal practice generally, may conduct visits, and then in B, subclause 6.5b, may advise the council on higher education established in the Higher Education Act regarding matters relevant to education in law. And then there was inserted by the committee the wording including the desirability of including in the LLB curriculum a form of community service to be undertaken by all law students. Apparently this is already the position at some of the universities. But I think the discussion went that the committee felt that we can't in this bill impose prescribed curriculum per se, but that we create a mechanism for the council to legitimately take this up with universities. Possibly that is as far as it can go.
All right. First, Dr. Machesta, and then Ms. Shrubbister.
Thank because if we talk about the desirability, and we sit here as lawmakers, we know from experience that the lawyers that we produce are not adequate to their tasks. They don't have a social conscience. Now we still leave it to another body to look at the desirability of the community. Maybe I don't have the right background how that was arrived, but I just have a problem that the power should reside somewhere, and if it can't reside with Parliament, I don't know how this power is distributed.
I think if I recall the discussion, Dr. Mosheka, and other members must assist me in case I leave anything out, the discussion went this way. We're a portfolio committee. We're not actually Parliament. And therefore, do we have the authority to say to every university who resort normally under the Minister of Higher Education and that relevant portfolio committee, do we have the authority to say to them, you will put in the curriculum community service to be undertaken by all those students? And so the feeling generally was, there was a feeling of discomfort. And we weren't sure if we could do that without first, at the very least, consulting with the relevant Minister of Higher Education. And remember, the universities have their own bodies. So there's a very wide-ranging consultation exercise that may need to be undertaken. And they may all agree and say, yes, it's an excellent idea, please put it in. But we just found ourselves in that awkward situation where we weren't sure that we could proceed with it. I please bear with me when I say this. I agree wholeheartedly with the sentiments you've expressed about social conscience. But let me hear Ms. Shrubbister. And then what?
Thank you, Chesterton. I think, Chesterton, we are, as this committee, entitled to do that. And if we doubt, we should work in cooperation with our other committee. But for us to leave an opportunity to do what we should do, I think we might be missing an opportunity, because what Dr. Mtsefa is saying is real. We have a challenge as this country of unemployment, because we've got universities who produce unemployable people, and we should have that at the back of our mind. While we make the law, we address some of our major challenges in the country. I want to suggest, Chairperson, that perhaps maybe yourself have a short discussion with the Chairperson for Higher Education, and you know, something like this.
Oh, sorry, Prof, and then Mrs. Swart.
Chair, if we had our way, we would really make community service compulsory. All the years I spent at university, I was dealing with a lot of social work students, apart from law students. Now, social workers are forced to do community service. It's part of the training. And they turn out to be relevant to the communities that they serve. I think that's a very important point we must remember. But having said that, we must also remember that universities are very, very particular about their academic freedom. Mm. So what we do, we must not infringe into the academic freedom of universities. Thanks.
Dr. Mucheka. I think when the professor...
Dr. Mucheka, I'm sorry, my apologies. I had recognized Mr. Swart before you.
I've just emphasized the point that was just made by the prof, and that is your academic freedom, your academic autonomy, and that's why we phrased it like that. One's got to be very careful, even from the minister's side, to dictate to universities what their curriculum should say. And I think we need to separate the different issues. The mere fact of the employability of law graduates and community service are two separate issues. The employability of legal graduates relates to your economy of the country and the amount of legal work that is available. What we are looking at here is having an aspect, and we had lengthy discussions on the value of the four-year LLB, if you remember that, and we came to the conclusion that it was not sufficient, and that's why we added in certain things for the curriculum, for the council to look again. But again, it's visiting the universities, conduct visits, 65A, and setting standards, but not dictating the curriculum. And I think that one would be then going on to the area. So I think, Chair, you're welcome to have those discussions, but I think the Minister or the Portfolio Committee might come back to you and say, look, that's going into the academic freedom of that of the institutions. We can, as we say here, advise the Council. We can even say in our resolution as the Portfolio Committee that this should be looked into. But I think that we once got to be very careful of going into the prof would know better than I about the issue of academic freedom. Thank you, Chair.
No, Chairperson, I think that we must accept that we inherited colonial philosophy. And also bear in mind that we are saying we want to establish a developmental state. And if we want to establish a developmental state, we also have to gear our institutions to do things in a way that will advance that concept of a developmental state. Because I really don't think that we can have the type of academic freedom which would allow academics not to fall in line with the direction that the country wants to take. So I think that I think that we maybe at some point we'll need to define what we mean by academic freedom, because you have an underdeveloped country where the majority of the people are poor, they are unemployed, they have problems. So when we make laws, we must make laws which will speak to that situation rather than just inherit a concept from Europe which says academic freedom. What does that mean? So I am suggesting that at some point we have to engage with these concepts. What is academic freedom? There's nothing, even the right, to freedom as limitation. That's why we can put you in jail for life, whilst you have the right to be free.
Yeah. May I propose that we not have a debate? The assertions made are shocking. We will not have a debate because the relevant issues are captured in the Bill of Rights. Academic autonomy is part and parcel of the freedom of belief and opinion and speech, of which the right to receive freely information and to disseminate it is part.
It's in Section 16. It is part of the Bill of Rights. It is not up for discussion. End of story. Please.
Section 16 of the Constitution relates to freedom of expression, Ms. Smith. Yes. Please don't instruct me to read. I'm quite capable of reading without your instruction, Ms. Smith. Academic freedom and freedom of scientific research. Well, okay. Dr. Mocheha?
Would not necessarily mean that as a country, we would not say teach or structure your curriculum in such a way that the people you produce are able to serve the country. Because the point one is making is not to deny any freedom of speech or academic freedom, is to say the country needs the type of person power that can deliver. But that does not boil down to limiting the freedom of academic freedom. We simply say the curriculum must be structured in such a way that the people that are produced are able to do what they are being trained for. That's all. But anyway, let's leave it there. Just saying that maybe we are looking for something.
No, I agree with you. I don't have a problem with that. I think we must also take a little further the idea that we should somehow consult with Minister Nzimande and the relevant portfolio committee. But obviously, you know, there are a whole lot of other bodies. Each university sees itself as independent. I don't see any problem in this because presently the way it's drafted, it says the council may advise the council on higher education and may consult with SAQWA to determine competency standards. So presently what it means is that the council that we are establishing will meet with these bodies and discuss these matters. There's a view that it should be taken a lot further, and then there's a view that what is there in the bill at the moment suffices. This much.
I want to ask you a different question, but it arises from this. If members are talking in terms of only now going to consult Blaise Nzimande, our minister, what is your time frame, if I may ask? Because the last thing I heard, it was considered that we would have to conclude this bill by end September for it to go to the NCOP. For it to be passed by this parliament. That was the time. Now, in addition, I learned from the programming committee that there is a possibility of a sitting being called for legislation on the 19th. That would be next Thursday. My first thought was, oh, that must surely be for the LPD, because there is no further plenary until October. So, that's why I just want to ask you, I mean, because we seem to be working to different timescales here. Is it the intention that the LPB will be passed by the National Assembly by the end of September, in which case I don't understand why we're thinking of going to consult the Minister of National Education? Or is it the case that you are going to give the bill the time it actually does require, which is actually two more years? So I just want to get some sort of a sense of where we are time-wise.
We can actually do both. Yes, we can. Because you're forgetting that the bill still has to go to the NCOP.
I said we have to pass it by end September for it to go to the NCOP,
yes,
for
yes.
This parliament to pass it before
please
the election.
Finish, Ms. Smith. Whilst it's with the NCOP, those consultations may take place. All right. Well, it's either next Thursday or in October. Well,
Make one comment. I mean, I think we must be very careful making broad statements that people don't have a social conscience. There are many people who have a very much of a social conscience. And I know some firms who actually created a special community service kind of wing of their practices. So I think let's just be fair and acknowledge that some people do, in fact.
I don't think Dr. Macheka was saying everyone. I think he was saying there are certain people in the profession. Sure. We acknowledge that. All right, let's proceed.
Thank you, Jay. The next clause is clause 34, forms of legal practice. There was a discussion on this again, specifically on clause, sub-clause 4 and 5. It relates to the insertion of the South African Human Rights Commission. It relates to the, if I could read subclause 4, attorneys may only practice for their own account as part of a juristic entity and as part of a non-profit juristic entity, as part of a law clinic, LASA, or as an attorney in the full-time employment of the state or the South African Human Rights Commission. At the last meeting, we were requested to delete Human Rights Commission and replace it by all the Chapter 9s. But we were asked to just do further research in this respect. In other words, to ascertain whether all the Chapter 9 institutions require the service of a practicing attorney and advocate. In this respect, we have a long footnote. Can I read it? It is the research we did. It reads, on 4 September, the committee decided that reference must be made to all the Chapter 9 institutions, not only the Human Rights Commission. The department raises the question whether this is correct. In terms of the Human Rights Commission Act, the commission is the only Chapter 9 institution which can litigate. Section 7 of this Act deals with the powers, functions and duties of the commission. Section 7(1)(e) of the Act reads as follows, and in addition to any other powers, duties and functions conferred on or is assigned to it by Section 116 of the Constitution, this Act or any other law, the Commission in E may bring proceedings in a competent court or tribunal in its own name or on behalf of a person or a group or a class of persons. There is no similar provision in the Commission on Gender Equality Commission Act or in fact in any of the other legislation regulating the Chapter 9 institutions. In fact, the GCE Act envisages matters being referred to the Human Rights Commission in the case of litigation. See Section 11(1)(e) of the Commission on Gender Equality Commission Act dealing with the powers and functions of the GCE, which is similar in purport to Section 7 of the Human Rights Commission Act, and it reads as follows. 1. In order to achieve its objects referred to in Section 193 of the Constitution, the Commission shall investigate any gender-related issues of its own accord or in receipt of a complaint and shall endeavor to resolve any dispute or rectify any act or omission by mediation, conciliation or negotiation, provided that the Commission may at any stage refer any matter to the Human Rights Commission to deal with it in accordance with the provisions of the Constitution and the law, or the public protector or any other authority. Many government departments and other institutions, including Chapter 9 institutions, have attorneys employed by them, but these are attorneys on a non-practicing role and cannot appear or litigate on behalf of the employers. They do not practice as attorneys, even though they are attorneys. They are employed as advisors, etc. The only exception in this regard is in the case of state attorneys who are employed in terms of the State Attorneys Act, and would you indeed practice as attorneys. To include a reference to all Chapter 9 institutions here might give rise to unintended consequences. This is just submitted for the committee's consideration. Chair, in essence, the department's feeling is that only the Human Rights Commission's people should be acknowledged here as a form of practice. It doesn't mean that they are not doing legal work as such. Because currently I spoke to a person there, apparently some of the law societies currently do allow them to practice as such. But that is an informal arrangement that they want it formalized.
Listening to the research team, so maybe let us keep it to the commission.
Is there anyone with a different view?
No.
Okay. You persuaded us.
Thank you, Chair. Then there's just a little drafting matter in subclause 5 relating to advocates. It was inserted in paragraph D as part of legal aid South Africa. We feel it might be more appropriate to insert it after as a state advocate at an institution, but that is only drafting. It wouldn't change any substance.
As a state advocate, is
Chair, my apologies. May Comrade Sheila and I go to the Auditor General.
I have a note to that effect. You already have as a state advocate under E.
Yes, Chair. And then we would insert and insert the Human Rights Commission there, rather than in paragraph D.
Now I understand. All right. Fine. Are we okay with that, Honourable Members? Good. Okay.
May I raise one last thing under clause 34 before you go to something else? And they're still dealing with 34.
Yes.
derive from what we did last week. But in subsection 11, which is one of the most important things in this bill, and the two really important things are, in my view, the inquiries we are asking the council to make. That'll be the real work of the council. 11, as it stands, says the council must, within 2 or 3 years after the commencement of Chapter 2, investigate and make recommendations to the minister on the creation of other forms of legal practice. That is including, that's not a closed list, I acknowledge that, but including limited liability legal practices, multidisciplinary, as well as the recognition of paralegals. I just want to ask you, is it not desirable to make it clear how wide they can cast the net? Could we not say, use the phrase from other jurisdictions, ask them to look at alternative business models or alternative business structures, specifically in which both, for example, legal practitioners and practitioners of other, including financial disciplines, offer their services in joint practice. Remember, we only ask them to inquire into this. But I think that they should be encouraged to think boldly. And my question is, whether this shouldn't be, the net shouldn't be cast wider.
What Ms. Smuts is proposing, honourable members, is that the council should also look at situations, Dr. Mishika and Mr. Sibanyoni, where presently an attorney practices as an attorney. He's not allowed to be joined by an architect, an accountant, and so on. And what she's proposing is that the council now must start looking at those situations. Currently, in other jurisdictions, that is being allowed. An attorney is allowed to practice with an accountant or a GP, an architect. But I thought multidisciplinary practices covered that.
Yeah, so arguably, and could I hear Mr.
All right. Anybody?
These things, you see, we've not defined them. We haven't defined them. So I think we should know that half the reason why I said it can't be is that it's clear that it's required.
Wait before you, Dr. Machika. No, I can't force them to respond. Yes. But Ms. Schaefer and then Dr. Machika.
I think multidisciplinary relates really only to other professions. Perhaps we might not want that. I mean, I know Dean and JJ were very excited about the idea of the shopping wall kind of thing in
schools
or whatever. And I don't think that kind of thing would be covered by it. So I think alternative business models might well be a better option.
Yeah. It's far bolder idea than having to find the
anybody else? Dr. Machika?
Here is the reference to other jurisdictions. We favor this information. Where is that? Is that in this country or elsewhere?
No, as overseas, other countries.
I thought that we are really dealing with transitional matters. We are transforming our business. It's not broaden.
But it's not precluded, Ms. Smuts. It says, when it says including, it's understood there that these are just some of them, but there could be more.
Our legal professions are very, like all legal professions, very good. I'm not convinced that they are aware of just how ambitious the changes abroad have been, how they have transformed the legal services market. How well lawyers are doing out of it, you see. I mean, I think we have to assist them to get away from the view that practicing the law is a sheltered sector, as it has been called by the IMF. That if you open up a bit, if you innovate, it's to everybody's benefit. The potential clients benefit from it, the lawyers themselves benefit from it, because they've made in practice in far more innovative ways. Provided you make sure they have the right qualifications. That's how you look after your citizens and consumers. But stimulate innovation. Above all, a country like ours needs it, but we've got a problem. People aren't getting legal services.
many of the lawyers feel they aren't getting clients, something is wrong. So, you know, why not allow them to go and explore all sorts of business practices?
Mr. Dyer? Chair, Honourable Swatch has a point. Charlie has a point. good points. I can only reflect on the UK model. So what they have is multidisciplinary structures, different disciplines.
What does that mean?
Architects, tax, lawyers, social workers, different disciplines. Then they have alternative business structures.
What
is same discipline, different structures, lawyers, advocates. So no harm will be done if we just include if we include alternative business structures. Just to cover the point made on this month, it just includes that.
And we're not encroaching on their independence by doing that? Are you sure? We need to think about that. I mean, really, you know.
Chair, no, I'm very firm on that. That's
I know
also,
you are. That's
also the reason
now if we're not encroaching on their independence.
We've
yet.
Discussed this before. The same applies to the inquiry into legal costs. They are the regulator. They must do the inquiry. They bring the recommendation to the minister for tabling in Parliament. If legislative effect is given, Parliament legislates. Right? That is, for example, why it is perfectly safe to put the costs question in their hands. I personally think their own codes have something to do with the cost thing. But that's my view. I don't write it into the law. The safeguard is, should the inquiry find that there is such a factor, it comes to us, we legislate, or you, I won't be here, you legislate, and there's your safeguard because you must act in the public interest. We're only asking for an inquiry, but it would be a mistake not to ask for the inquiry because they must do the inquiry. You can't leave them the way, they can't just carry on the way they are.
Fair enough. Alternative business models.
Yes, Chair, it will be remiss of me if I don't share this with the committee. I've just been assigned a capacity to oversee the Secretariat of the Law Reform Commission.
Oh, good.
I have now, in that program, I have now noticed that there is a research which was approved 2 years ago for the Law Reform Commission to investigate the very same matter.
The very same matter.
Yes. Now, I'm just, and I know that in terms of the of our option, this will only kick within 2 or 3 years after the commencement of investigating. And the Law Reform Commission has been assigned to do the marginal practice investigation. And the Law Reform Commission comprises of experts in the legal field and not necessarily interest people who are putting themselves and judges, whatever, and go through the broad consultation process that allow everybody else to engage the process. I don't know what the rules of engagement will be from the council, the structure to be established, whatever. All I'm trying to say is that in the next 2 or 3 years, we might be having a document that would have come from the Law Reform Commission because it was program.
Dr. Mashekha and then Ms. Lutz.
Now, if that is the situation, are we saying that let's preempt the outcome of that investigation and legislate on the matter that is being investigated?
Ms.
Lutz.
No, it's exactly the same situation. The Law Reform Commission does wonderful work. I couldn't be more thrilled than I am to hear this. Their work, however, takes quite a while, right? So they are always under the chairmanship of the judge. They will do some real inquiry. If these two inquiries cross-pollinate, I think that's a wonderful idea. The Law Reform Commission is an independent statutory body, but they report to the minister, who also tables, I think all their reports come to us. And so any actual legislative action in that scenario will flow from the normal executive plus parliamentary process. The same applies to an inquiry by the legal profession itself. It makes an inquiry. It must make an inquiry. I still insist they must. Then they make recommendations to the minister on the creation of other forms of legal. And that necessarily would entail statutory amendment, because as things stand, we legislate in South Africa the forms of legal practice. There is absolutely no harm in the two inquiries running simultaneously. The judge's inquiry has the great virtue that it is above all self-interest. It will draw in experts from the profession. They always do. They will consult, ask their views, but they'll come to their own. The interesting thing about the Legal Practice Council is this is the profession. And don't forget the unhappiness on your side that there are only three ministerials. In my view, the ministerials should precisely be experts in this kind of thing. Now, you're going to have a legal practice with a preponderance of legal practitioners. Make them go and do an inquiry. Then that sits alongside the law commissions. Let's see what the differences are. If there's any, they're supposed to regulate in the public interest, but if there are some self-interested aspects to their report, that'll be very interesting to compare to what the law commission comes out with, as we used to call the Law Reform Commission. I think it's a superb idea that both of them inquire into this. Well, after all, we're looking for answers to the problems with access to justice in this country, aren't we?
With respect, Chief, we are already talking about challenges of resources. Why should we duplicate processes? I think the legitimate process that has started and the department is involved in it, overseeing it, why don't we give that process a chance and then we do other things that are added?
Let's do this, Dr. Chair. And I thought that's what Mr. Skosana was proposing, that the Law Reform Commission is still seized with this attack. It'll be a while before the council is actually up and running. What prevents, when the council is established, from it saying to the Law Reform Commission, you've done this work. Let's see what you've done. And it's not compelled, okay? Because the word there, it's must, eh? Must investigate. So it's investigated. It takes the Law Reform Commission's work, looks at it, so it's investigated. And then takes it from there. There's no compulsion on its part not to do anything or to do anything. All right? No. We leave must there. We leave must there. But of course, it's not compelled. What I'm saying to Dr. Mucheka is the Law Reform Commission, I don't know, I'm assuming that within this 2 or 3 years, it will have completed this investigation. And will have come forward with a report and recommendations, which is what it normally does. And sometimes it tables those reports in Parliament, Dr. Mucheka, for us to consider. It will obviously make certain recommendations for the Minister to take forward. Now, when the Council is established, which will be in 2016 or 17, then it can take what the Law Reform Commission has done, look at it, and decide whether it wants to implement or not. Okay? Yeah. I think we must be grateful to Mrs. Sana for bringing this to our attention, and we're very excited about your comments about the Law Reform Commission.
Have you been assigned a role there, Debbie? Wonderful. What is it?
I'm the secretary of the Law Reform Commission until the end of January.
Okay, and who's been wonderful? And who's been appointed to lead it?
Judge Meyer.
Mandisa Meyer.
The chairperson. Judge Judy Colapel, the vice chairperson.
Okay, let's move on.
Thank you, Jay. Clause 35, relating to fees. There was a discussion, and then a fourth alternative to sub-clause 4 was proposed by Ms. Smith. It relates to the inquiry or investigation. It's a rewording, and the rewording has the effect that no assumptions are made by the legislator, but the matter is thrown to the council to investigate. I don't know if I should read it.
No, you don't have to read it. We have it in front of us.
It's clause 35.
Clause
35. Subclause 4, the fourth alternative to subclause 4.
Which begins on 41 and runs on to page 42. All right. Then we'll have to take decisions on those alternatives on the domain. Okay. Mr. Scorsone?
And I also wish to also bring that other aspect that we just discussed. Also wish to bring the attention of the committee that already there are initiatives underway by the minister arising from the Supreme Court Act relating to the rule-making specific in this country to revise and reform the rules about for courts of law. And part of the reforms underway is to give it more meaningful role, including investigating and advising aspects relating to fees pertaining to legal services. Because currently the rules court is responsible for a certain part of fee, court fee, from practitioners. So the idea is to look at broadening its mandate. And by the time the council is established, it does for investigation. There may have been legislation already brought by the minister before this parliament regarding the same aspect, whatever. So the committee must be aware of that, because our understanding is that this provision does not stop the minister or government from initiating means to address aspects relating to the fees, whatever, on an ongoing basis. I just want to make that clear.
Okay.
That was when we were first pondering this whole difficulty about fees and what was tabled. In other words, a fee structure, which doesn't mean very much. Somebody, and I suspect yourself, or Lawrence, or Mr. Dyer, came up with the idea that we should look at the rules board, and which does at the moment litigious fees, but not non-litigious tariffs. And we all thought that was one real possible answer, and it's one of our options, not so. I personally think that we should go the inquiry route, but there can't be any harm in the law advisors at Justice, which I'm sure would include Lawrence and Mr. Dyer, and always your wise eye. I don't think there's any harm in the ministry beginning to look at amendments. It anyway comes back to the Justice Committee, and at that point you'll be able to see it. That won't happen until what? 2014, 2015? It will precede any inquiry this law does, because first they have to be set up as a consultative. So you would not want to preempt, I would think. But it would be for you to look at when it comes.
When it comes to fees, I have a very strong instinct that we should preempt.
Mm.
The way things are going now.
Mm.
You listen to the people, you see what's happening out there. Oh, boy.
That's arguable, but what is your best mechanism is the difficult question. It's because we've been grappling with it so much, we've created more than one option.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause that was discussed last week is clause 48, appointment and independence of legal services ombud. The committee decided that the ombud must be a retired judge, and consequential amendments also flows to clause 50 and 51, and therefore an alternative, second alternative option to subclause 1 was inserted, reading the president must, as soon as practical, after the commencement of this act, appoint a judge discharged from active service
as legal services ombud.
Judge
as any constitutional judge or judge referred to in Section 1 of the Judges Act, which includes a judge who has been discharged from active service in terms of that act. The JSC Act provides for matters relating to misconduct of judges, and that act is the only one applicable to judges in respect of misconduct. So Clause 51 was consequentially amended. Subclause 1 was deleted. Subclause 2 remains. And 3 and 4. Clause 65. It relates to Fidelity Fund, qualification of membership of board. On 4 September last week, the committee accepted the further alternative option to paragraph C. That is similar to what we discussed earlier regarding the council.
Okay.
Chair Clause 84. Handling of trust monies, obligations of legal practitioner relating to trust money. This relates to the discussion earlier regarding Human Rights Commission or Chapter 9. We will just change it back to only refer to Human Rights Commission here. And then we were requested to provide for an exemption, possible exemption, and that is at the end of 84.1b, provided that the council may, in consultation with the board, exempt any attorney or advocate or legal practitioner in writing from this requirement on good cause shown. One already provides that certain people do not have state attorneys, etc. I'm not sure why we were requested to provide for a further exemption, except for just that there might be an instance, possibly if it was all the Chapter 9s, but I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question.
Mr. Dyer, can you help us? Chair, the committee discussed this matter and the point was made that there shouldn't be a blanket application to all Chapter 9 institutions, and that depending on the institution that requires this exemption, a provision should be drafted to cater for that eventuality or that instance. So it is in that context that this further alternative was inserted. To a blanket Chapter 9 institution.
Maybe the Chapter 9 is not available.
Possibly this provider should be deleted now that it's been decided that it only be the Human Rights Commission, and they are exempted in terms of the first part of subclause 1 already.
Does that make sense? All right, Ms. Lena Majata.
Thank you, Chair. I think we actually deliberated on this for a long time, and that's why we actually built precautionary measures, because it was felt that maybe it's just the South African Human Rights Commission that's included, it's at exclusion of other Chapter 9 institutions. is going to actually make it difficult for other Chapter 9 institutions if they find themselves in a situation where they want to litigate to find it possible to do so.
What is handling of trust money, Dr. Mucheha?
I think my colleague came in before the opinion was given, because it's in the light of that opinion that we have that we say we should change.
We are removing the reference.
Okay, in that case, Chair, I will concede to the provision.
All right, so that's settled. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 8410, sub-clause 10, it is just the same.
I'm sorry, Chairperson, I want to interject. May I interject? Sorry.
Yes.
I pose this question for the future possibility. Do we envisage that they would never, ever, in the history of the legal profession and this bill, be a Chapter 9 institution that can exist, a new Chapter 9 institution that can exist, that could possibly fall into a similar category as the Human Rights Commission that was to apply to the Council for exemption? Are we envisaging that that can never happen? If the committee says it's not possible, then I understand why we are making no provision for it.
All right, do that, Mr. Sivanian.
Is your fear that we are closing the door if we are putting this regulation? Because why I'm asking is, I think our mind is open. Remember, Kala Asma, the light, there are deliberations going on in the light. Now, my view would be, in the event a certain subterranean institution comes into being at the later stage, would it not be possible to amend this MPB to accommodate it? Because we don't know how we get what will be the effect of that. Is the door, completely closed or not?
Mr. Dyer, and then Mr. Skosana, followed by Mr. Schaefer, Mr. Swart, Ms. Ilana Majake, Dr. Mucheha, in that order?
Chair, my response is
okay.
My response is short. If you don't create it in the bill, you're going to have to amend the bill. Whereas if you create that provision, the application goes to council for exemption, and council either rejects it or it doesn't. So you create that mechanism, but you create the space for the possibility for it to exist.
In fact, with the Human Rights Commission, we are Parliament is taking a risk against the protection of the public. And I'm not sure that the Parliament may even wish to extend that risk to any other institution. Because the reality of the matter is that the fund and the scheme of the bill is there to protect the people. And Human Rights Commission are not only cause, they are not saying. If anything may go wrong, something will go wrong with the Human Rights Commission, whatever. And that's the risk we take. Now, I wouldn't imagine that will want to open it further. And I think experience with the Human Rights Commission may also teach us over some time. Parliament may have come back and scrap it again at some other point. So I suppose that leave the risk as it is, manage it, see what happens 5 years, 10 years down the line, and don't even create an opportunity for anyone to come through that window. That's my point.
All right. Mrs. Schaefer.
Yeah, I agree with Kosana, I don't agree with Mr. Dyer at all. Chapter 9 is a major, you don't just create another Chapter 9, it's a constitutional amendment, 2/3 majority in Parliament. If you're going to create something like that, then we can just change that. I don't agree at all with Mr. Dyer.
Yeah, no, just to say that So far from creating new institutions, Mr. Dyer's question, which might need this, we are looking at and likely to do just the opposite. It was the recommendation of the Chapter 9 review that the Human Rights Commission become an umbrella for the other commissions, gender, culture, language, etc. And that concept is, that report is now, we finished it in 2007, so the report itself is quite old. The proposal was dependent upon the excellence of the Human Rights Commission under Jody Colliver, Leon Bessels, and Garthi Govender.
So where are you going with this?
I'm saying that so far from new institutions being created which might need this provision, we are actually going in the other direction. There's a second reason why I mentioned the proposed umbrella, because we are looking at it again. And that is, when you appoint chairman tomorrow, the Human Rights Commissioner of our choice, please remember that if we turn the Human Rights Commission into an umbrella and fold the gender and the commission with a long name and others into it, then you are getting a whole lot of new candidates, and we already have 50% male, 50% female on the Human Rights Commission. I thought I would just abuse the opportunity.
Well, abuse is the correct word, because I just don't see where that has to do with handling of trust matters. Mr. Swart?
Actually, I agree that we should delete this very briefly. It's not only the new Chapter 9 institutions or that possibility, but any attempt, if you persuade the council that you must be exempt, you're opening that up to some abuse, and we don't need to open, and I agree with what Mr. Croissant said, this is to protect the public. We don't want to have that avenue that someone, you know, for opens it for abuse, so let's delete it.
Please don't respond to Ms. Smuts.
I must say, in terms of the principle of collapsing Chapter 9 institution, there's no report of that nature that has been accepted. But I agree with Mr. Skosana. There is risk, indeed. But then if you're going to have to include South African Human Rights Commission, then it goes takes another dimension of discriminating on other Chapter 9 institutions. Maybe what it means is that if there's so much of risk to continue to promote equality, then we simply just remove South African Human Rights Commission.
Legal settings. I think the opinion that we were given and the explanation that Ms. Kosana gives helps us to have a situation where all of us are certain what the situation is. Because the lawyers, we have one witness of wanting to create a situation that sometimes doesn't even exist. You know, just look at the dispute about legal aid for the minors. When the law is so clear that those people appear as witnesses, that they are witness fee, but then there's a big national argument to say, no, this government is denying people justice because of it. So I think let's go for something that is certain. And let's not legislate on the basis of what we think may happen in the future. So I am appealing that we, you know, last week for 2 days I was agreeing with Mr. Dias. Today I just want to agree with Mr.
You're very generous, Dr. Yes, I heard that earlier. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The same clause 84, subclause 10. It's just the same as we discussed now. The reference to Human Rights Commission is inserted there to provide that they shall not receive any keep money or property belonging to any person in trust. Just a consequential amendment to previous decision.
Okay.
Chair, I think that's all. I'm just quickly paging through the bill. The only other decision that was taken last week in clause 96 1B, as I mentioned earlier, it was that it should be one teacher of law on the transitional council.
Designated by the GCB, and so on.
question being posed is, when someone is removed, will it be the responsibility of those bodies to replace that person? I don't remember what we arrived at, but we were saying that after they have nominated people, then we have set up a new body. Now, if you are going to make changes in the new body to be at the pleasure of the designating body, and if there is instability within the designating body, then that then destabilizes the body that you've set up. I hear what you're saying, Dr. Machika. In this case, the person designated, for example, by the Law Society, is found to be thief and is removed effectively. So that, I hear what you're saying, and we raise that as a concern, that we don't want these bodies now, in the event that they are being destabilized or for some reason or another don't like the person they've designated, then decide, no, we're removing you for whatever reason. So there has to be valid reasons for that removal. Okay. But the question still remains, will it still be the designating body that... let me hear you.
I agree with you, and I mean, I haven't just got time to check whether the safeguards are in here or not, but I think we must make sure that they are, that there's got to be a valid reason for the person being removed. I mean, like they're facing a criminal charge or something like that. But I think it's even more important for the Transitional Council that that body that designates them does replace them, because they're going to be only in existence for a short period of time. So you don't really want to have people filling positions but not being there. So I think it is desirable, provided we've got the safeguards for that eventuality, that they should be replaced.
So
we have a full complement of people on that transition
plan. We need to think carefully about this situation. I hear what you're saying.
You know, because these bodies hold elections.
Yes.
And after elections, the new checks were filled that the remedy of the person is there.
Yes. You want him removed?
And you may find that a very serious assignment is the new family when you remove him. Then a new check comes, he has to start afresh. Unless that is good, but I agree with you, Chair, that we have to do this.
Chair, if I could just clarify, this specific paragraph relates to conviction of an offence. And it's that appeal period that could drag on for years. So it's not just any removal. This is specifically where there's been a conviction of an offence in a court of first instance.
Yeah.
So it's really limited.
You see on page 85, Dr. Machefa, it specifically says, a person who has been convicted in a court of first instance, that's different. It's not the right to remove the person. It's the right to replace a person who is disqualified to serve. But in that sense, there should be a problem.
Okay.
Anything else? Good. All right. Well, yes? 100.
Chair, clause 100 relates to the chairperson and deputy chairperson of the TC. The alternative option to sub clause 6 reads, in the office of a chair or deputy chair, if it becomes vacant, the minister must, after consultation. This was the decision last week. I'm not sure if this is what the honourable member...
I'd like us to just relook at that again. Chair, what happened last week was a lot of the discussions around in or after consultation
was raised by the learned doctor. And this was another situation of that. So I'd like us to reconsider that, the question of in and after.
But it,
thank you.
And Chair, may I just add a reference to sub 6? There's also an alternative in sub 6.
Yes, we see.
It's for which we are not committed, which is that if either the chair or the deputy office become vacant, the minister can designate one of the others.
Whether it's in consultation or after. That's the concern they're raising, and there's no finality as far as that's concerned. Anything else? No? That's it? All right. Well, I'm beginning to see the lights at the end of the tunnel. I don't understand why the parliamentary program has been designed the way it has. I'm not saying this as a criticism, but it's very odd. You know, we have these gaps that spring up at the oddest times, and in my mind, you know, we're going to be working and doing things, and people say, no, you won't be. You'll be in your constituency. But clearly, I would like us to finalize this bill by that Thursday that was referred to earlier. Yeah, next week. So, those of you, look, it's 117 clauses. Well, the three-day rule sometimes is suspended. The point I'm trying to make is, please try and share this with your caucuses. I know it's hard, it's 117 clauses, and there are a fair number of issues here that we've flagged and made firm positions on. However you do it. Okay. What else do we have? Just a moment. Thank you. Okay. I'm being put under pressure with regard to, I don't know why. Perhaps there are other people exerting their influence. For some reason, I'm constantly being asked whether we will finalize the Human Rights Commission bill by the 18th of October. My reading is that we can actually finish before that date. Mr. Sidonyane, we've just about done everything that needs to be done. So, you know, whenever we can, let's give a careful look at it and see what's left and what's outstanding. I had sent a message, Mr. Skosana, through, unfortunately, because I didn't have Mr. Gilanga's contact details, through Mr. Bassett. But I also followed it up by saying to Mr. Bassett, you must please inform Mr. Gilanga that he mustn't sit back and think, well, it's the 18th of October. We're actually looking at bringing it forward. So you know, there were instructions he left here with, and this way the next time he comes here, which will be there. Is it Labistachni? Yes, my apologies, Labistachni. All right. Mr. Romano is proposing that we deal with that in the first week of Constituency Week. It says Constituency Week, and then they promptly tell us we have to meet and work as a committee. That's our lot. Okay.